Sup, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. I sat down with the economics professor of Twitter, Professor Peter Saint-Ange. Talk about hyperinflation, how it may come to America, how it has happened over the last 100 years, particularly in Weimar, Germany, and Argentina. Talked about a bunch of other stuff as well. White pill. Be optimistic, freaks. This rip was brought to you by our good friends at River. River's the best place to buy Bitcoin. You can easily buy and sell using the app. If you dollar cost average, you're not going to pay any fees on those buys. If you set up a daily, weekly, bi-weekly, monthly, whatever it is, you set that up, set it and forget it. You're not going to pay any fees on that. They have limit orders as well. So maybe you want to price snipe and set your buy below where the current price is or above where the current price is. You can easily do that within the app now as well. They have auto withdrawals. They really value self-custody at River. So you can give them an address to a wallet that you control. And once you hit a certain threshold, they'll send the Bitcoin directly to that wallet. They're doing it the right way. They build everything in-house. They don't have any third-party dependencies. They don't depend on Fortress Trust or Prime Trust or any other third parties. They build their wallets, their multi-sig cold storage in-house. Everything's backed one-to-one, fully reserved. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. Great time to start sacking sats. River's a great place to do it, not financial advice. This report was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained. It's lively down there right now. And in the year strong down the hall. They're leading the way in terms of leveraging Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties to bring you products that give you peace of mind, whether that's their vault product, their core product, which is a 2 or 3 multi-sig, where you can hold 2 keys, you can hold 1 key, you can hold no keys. They've got multi-institution, multi-sig now, partnerships with CoinCover, Kingdom Trust. They just announced Bakkt last week, really leading the way on multi-institutional, multi-sig. Again, they had that vault product. You can buy Bitcoin easily and sell Bitcoin via Unchained. Buy, send it directly to your vault. They have an RIA product, which gives you peace of mind, knowing that your retirement funds are in Bitcoin in a wallet with keys that you control. You can roll your IRA over. They have an inheritance protocol, too. Talk about peace of mind. Passing your Bitcoin on is a big problem that many people think of. Unchained has created an inheritance product, a protocol to make that as easy as possible. So hit them up, go to unchained.com/consultation to learn more about what they're building, why they're building it, and why you should be securing your Bitcoin, interacting with their products. They do it the right way, freaks. unchained.com/consultation. Set up a call today. This rip was also brought to you by friends at CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is here to help you bring sovereignty to your healthcare. If you're in Bitcoin, you're finding monetary sovereignty in the Bitcoin protocol. You should go seek sovereignty in other parts of your life. Healthcare is one of the pivotal parts of your life. CrowdHealth is really attacking the health insurance model, which is typically expensive, opaque, impersonal. CrowdHealth isn't health insurance. It's crowdfunded healthcare. You join the CrowdHealth community. You pay a monthly fee. If you ever go to the doctors, you pay the first $500 of that bill, then the rest is crowdfunded by the CrowdHealth community. They have a Bitcoin community, and the beauty of CrowdHealth is that you have health advocates, so you can get a personal experience, talk to somebody to advise you on what to do if you have a healthcare incident or health event that you need to take care of. They advocate for you with the doctors. Since you're paying out doctors in cash, they can negotiate prices lower, and they get very steep discounts on everything. It's a beautiful thing. If you're looking to take sovereignty over your healthcare, me and my family have done this. We've been using CrowdHealth for almost 2 years. The experience has been incredible. It's much better than the health insurance industry. We were on Cobra, very expensive. CrowdHealth is much cheaper, much better experience. It's a beautiful thing. Go to joincrowdhealth.com/TFTC. Sign up today, and you're going to get $99 for your first 6 months of subscriptions to the CrowdHealth community. Join crowdhealth.com/TFTC. This report was also brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. If you're a company in the space looking to hire talent, to poach talent from the tech industry, from the banking industry, go get onboarded with Bitcoin Talent Co. They understand Bitcoin. They know multi-sig. They know mining. They know Lightning. They're not just some run-of-the-mill recruiting firm that's going to try and gouge you for fees. They actually are going to help you find the talent that you need. And since they know Bitcoin, they know what you're looking for. They have a flex product as well. Maybe you don't need a full-time employee. You just need a contractor for 3 months, 6 months to help you on a development sprint, a design sprint, growth marketing sprint. You can tap into their flex network as well. If you're looking to get into the space and get into the best companies in the space, and you're in the tech industry or the banking industry or somewhere else, go set up a profile with Bitcoin Talent Co. Get in the mix, get your resume out there, and come help us build a future built on a Bitcoin standard. Go to bitcointalent.co. Tell them that TFTC sent you. Enjoy this rip with Twitter's economic professor. Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
They're going to try and ban Bitcoin.
Yeah, for sure.
That should be the base case.
I'm constantly shocked they haven't tried harder. It's the great mystery. I think they literally don't understand it. And they are little by little, but not fast enough to be a problem yet.
That's what I can see this BlackRock ETF being the beginning of them getting it and trying to corral it into this hyper-regulated exposure, where it's like, all right, you can get exposure to Bitcoin, but it has to be via these entities.
Exactly. Yeah. Which are we recording yet?
Yes.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. I mean, the trick with BlackRock, I think the biggest benefit to it is that BlackRock knows how to lobby Washington, right? So, you know, they've got so many friends that, you know, in a sense, it gives us like plot armor on this side to have BlackRock on the Bitcoin side of it. And then the question is just, is BlackRock going to try to screw things up internally, you know, more than the sort of policy insurance that they give Bitcoin?
Yeah. That's been a big debate in the Bitcoin space, is should we be funding these policy think tanks and these policy advocacy groups to go lobby on our behalf? And I've been a big advocate of, let's just piggyback on other lobbies.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more focused on the energy sector. I think we should get the energy sector bought in and then use their lobby to protect Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah. They're one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. They're insane. The kind of garbage policies they can get through. You know, if you were to aim that lobbying muscle at something that actually made sense, it'd be pretty exciting.
Yeah. Well, nothing makes sense right now.
Very little makes sense. This is one of the great mysteries is, you know, like if I were rooting for Joe Biden, you know, if I were like a dedicated Democrat activist, I would be like, what in the hell are you guys doing? You know, between like the border and the gender thing and, you know, the wars, you know, the retreat from Afghanistan. I mean, just the litany is astounding. Like, what are you people doing? And it's almost like they're behaving as if they really don't care what the voters think. You know, normally, if you look at, say, pre-Obama, you know, you look back to the Clinton era, for example, at least they tried to dress things up. Like they tried to do policies, for example, border fences and things. Okay. Yes, they were, you know, doing them less so than the Republicans might, but they were at least trying to respond to what they thought public opinion was. And in a whole lot of areas, it's like they really don't care. And, you know, I did an article on this recently talking about voter fraud, that this is what you would expect to see if a regime is engaging in widespread voter fraud, that they don't care about voters anymore, right? Because the reason you do voter fraud is so you can ignore the other side's voters. But as a side effect, you can also ignore your own side's voters. So you become like divorced from voters. You really don't care what they think anymore. Rather, you know, the party gets handed over to special interests, so lobbyists and cronies, and the politicians themselves, the bureaucrats. And that's really, I think, what the Democrat Party is looking like now. It, you know, there are all of these sort of own goals, you know, things like banning gas stoves. I mean, where the heck is that coming from? You know, like what is the benefit to the party, right? Like again, you know, if I put myself in the shoes of like a pro, you know, Democrat activist, I'm like, what in the heck is up with the gas stoves? Unforced air, nobody was demanding it. The climate freaks aren't obsessed about gas stoves. You know, it's like the White House just pulled this out of their rear end. Pulled it out of nowhere. And, you know, I mean, that's, you're not going to win elections on things like that. So it's just across the board, they act like they're a party that, you know, whether it's confidence in the media covering for them or whether it's genuine voter fraud, they feel like they really don't care what voters think anymore.
No, I mean, just having Joe Biden go out there and interact with either the public or other world leaders is an example. Yeah. Like that gaffe in China where he walked up to Xi unannounced.
Yeah.
Probably whispered something incoherently in his ear without a translator.
Probably sniffed him. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can, I mean, you can tell, speaking of sniffing, the other powers in the world can smell the blood in the water. I mean, you have Saudi Arabia and China buddying up pretty yeah. aggressively. Saudi Arabia, their foreign minister came out and said, we're going to go to China and see if they can broker yep. peace.
Yeah.
Between Israel and Palestine, and it's
yeah,
it is perplexing.
The in a sense, I would welcome the incompetence if it was paired with like a retreat from the world. You know, like if we became isolationists and then Joe Biden could sniff people here at home, that's relatively harmless. You know, but the problem is that you're pairing that incompetence with this just extremely aggressive foreign policy. You know, we've learned recently, I think it was the German foreign minister who was talking about early peace talks between Ukraine and Russia and that the U.S. was spiking them. Like they were essentially telling Ukraine, no, you cannot make peace. And, you know, why would they do that? You know, you've got, what, something like 100,000 Ukrainians now who have lost their lives apparently for nothing, given that the war is winding down at this point. So why would you do that? And, you know, is it military donors? Is it, you know, to sort of maintain this sense of crisis that they enjoyed during COVID, where they could ram stuff through. And so they figured, well, you know, the COVID shtick is played out. And so maybe we can go for war this time. Now, I guess they found a new shiny war, so they don't need the Ukraine one. But I mean, really just, you know, pairing, if the US were isolationist, it wouldn't much matter if we were incompetent, right? But in this day and age, when the US is out there trying to pick fights with pretty much every conflict in the world, it's a big concern.
Yeah, it's pretty disgusting too. I mean, when stuff began popping off in Israel, in Gaza, the haste with which the Ukraine debacle was swept under the rug.
It was like, you know, the Friday Night Girl, you know, you keep her handy and then as soon as you meet another one, she's just out of there. It was astounding. And, you know, of course, the Ukrainian people, I mean, they've been through, the Russian people as well. You know, early on in the conflict, you know, people were sort of choosing sides. And I mean, my argument at the time, I think you probably agree, is that, you know, I was on the side of the Ukrainian people and the Russian people. I was against the Ukrainian government and the Russian government. You know, so this entire debacle here, I mean, honestly, like it's hard to quantify how little I care who runs the Donbas region of Ukraine. I could absolutely care less. Both countries are corrupt dictatorships. Broadly speaking, it seems that Russia is slightly less corrupt. But beyond that, I really don't have an opinion. So why we got involved in the first place, and you know, along the way, how many thousands of Ukrainians and Russians were killed. So, I mean, in a sense, if you kind of zoom out, it's like the U.S. is almost like this dying scorpion who just sort of stabs everything it sees. It stabs its own babies. It just stabs anything in sight in its death throes.
Yeah, it seems like it was heavily driven by the military-industrial complex. I mean, you had Mitch McConnell come out on one of the Sunday news shows about a month ago and saying, hey, this is good for American weapons companies. We're basically giving them all of our old ammo and then remaking it here.
Yeah. Finally, we're
staying in the U.S.
Yeah. We're revitalizing the Rust Belt by making stuff and blowing it up. Yeah. As opposed to like making things that people could actually use, like cars.
Well, they're going to make cars, but they're all going to be electric cars by 2030. Apparently.
They're going to be, you know, there was an article just the other day that 0.2% of car registrations are currently electric cars. For all the mind share they have, for all the billions that they're going to plow into these charging networks and all this, essentially nobody has an EV. The other issue with EVs is that China has been plowing ungodly sums into anything green. Okay, so they've been dumping free money into manufacturers of solar panels and electric vehicles and batteries and all across the board. And all of that stuff is set to flood into the U.S. now, right? So we have all these crony Solyndra-style, you know, electric vehicle plants in this. I think Tesla is like the one company that's relatively sustainable on its own merits. But the rest of this crap is just, I mean, it's just pure government welfare. And then once you bring China flooding in, what, millions of electric vehicles are going to slash the prices, are going to be half the cost. So, you know, between customers sort of waking up to the fact that EVs, for the most part, are a bait and switch, you know, like an EV truck, well, you know, you can drive it for like an hour and then you get to spend a couple more hours at the charger. So between them understanding that the product itself, in most cases, doesn't perform anywhere near the promises, and then you combine that with the Chinese flooding in with all this cut rate product, you know, I think we're just gonna have an absolute wipeout in, you know, so-called green manufacturing. Now they're gonna double down on it, right? Going back to the, you know, first point that they really don't care what voters think anymore. They're just gonna double down, I think. So the Chinese are gonna come in, they're gonna try to put trade restrictions, you know, they're going to dump more money into these black holes because it's about the messaging. It's about their own crony environmentalists, which are a big part why Joe Biden, you know, took the White House.
Yeah, well, it actually gets to a good segue into what I actually wanted to cover. I originally reached out to you a few weeks ago after that whole Treasury auction debacle. Apparently, there was a cyber attack. China couldn't get their trades in. The demand for the 30-year... Was it 30-year or 20-year? I think it was 30-year treasury. It was the lowest it's been since 1991.
Yeah.
And I think that we can actually cover that subject and tie it into something that you've been covering a lot this week, which is hyperinflationary events throughout history. We just had the 100-year anniversary of the Weimar Republic's hyperinflationary event. Obviously, Argentina just had a big election with Javier Milei becoming their president in the midst of their fifth hyperinflationary event in the last 5 decades or however long it's been. And I think we could use sort of that 100-year anniversary and what's going on in Argentina right now to describe some hyperinflationary events over the last 100 years. And I think that treasury auction is a signal that if there's not demand for these treasuries, we could have it here. And even if the government does want to double down on the stupid spending that they're doing, whether it's in energy or other areas of the economy, they may run into a buzzsaw that is runaway inflation, potentially hyperinflation.
Yeah. So what happened in the treasury auctions, this was, I think, 2 weeks ago at this point, and they hold these things often, but they were trying to sell, I want to say 10 or 20 billion worth of federal debt. And they do that essentially nonstop. They've got something like $10 trillion in debt that they have to flog out to private markets this year. So they've got a lot of these treasury auctions. And to put that in perspective, there's about $20 trillion in the U.S. banking system. Okay, and the feds this year are trying to sell $10 trillion, right? Most of that is refinancing old debt and then about $2 trillion in fresh debt. So it is really an enormous sum of money that they're trying to pump out into private markets. And there had been a concern over the past month or two that there's an accumulating risk premium on U.S. debt because markets are losing their appetite to buy it. Okay, and so in that context, we had this auction a couple of weeks ago that was just really exceptionally weak. A lot of people have been watching auctions for a long time. Guys like James Lavish, they said it was just catastrophic. You had very little demand for the debt being auctioned. It came out at at a very high price, meaning at, you know, a high cost to the treasury, to the taxpayer. And even so, about a quarter of it was left unsold. So that goes to so-called primary dealers who basically flog unwanted debt onto the secondary markets. So this was a near catastrophic auction. Now, subsequent auctions have been fine. Okay, so that's you know, kind of the context here. But the thing is, it's a little bit like if you're flying in a plane and you hear a loud bang. Okay, you're still flying. You haven't gone down yet, but that's something that you might want to look into before you continue too long. So that's kind of a canary in the coal mine, these treasury auctions. And I think the last time we talked about the fact that, you know, the pattern throughout the history of the Federal Reserve has been that they hike rates until they break something. And every time it's something different that breaks. You know, last time in 2008, it was mortgages, mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations. And it's often little obscure things like that, right? So when 2008 hit, there were all these explainer articles in like the Wall Street Journal and Barron's Magazine, which is the kind of one of the in-house publications for Wall Streeters. And there were all these explainers saying, what is a collateralized debt obligation? What is a mortgage-backed security? Because nobody knew what these were, right? It's not like these were huge industries. Everybody was, you know, watching like a hawk and then they blew up. These were more like ghosts in the machine, okay? These were like gremlins. And, you know, of course, compared to 2008, our financial system is a lot more baroque. Debt is much higher. I think it's over twice what it was in 2008 throughout the system. A lot of the restrictions that were put on during 2008, you know, Wall Street outranks bureaucrats by like 20 points in IQ, right? So every time that the bureaucrats try to fix Wall Street, I mean, it takes them about 10 minutes to route around this thing. In fact, if by some freak of chance you happen to get a bureaucrat with a brain, you can guarantee you Goldman Sachs is going to sit down and have lunch with them and talk about the bright future they shall have someday with Goldman Sachs. All right. All of these guys are either idiots or they're compromised. So I don't want to imagine what kinds of gremlins are hiding inside of our financial system waiting to break. But, you know, treasury auctions that's a massive, massive market. If a treasury auction does actually break, in other words, if it goes unsold, that or if the interest rate skyrockets, that would be something that'd be absolutely catastrophic for the economy. But even beyond that, the question is, how many gremlins do we have tied up in there? So I think, you know, sort of the storyline from Washington, no matter what happens, is that they trot out Janet Yellen, Jerome Powell, even Biden himself. They all come out and reassure us how everything is just fine. It's blatant dishonesty, you know, to the point where, like, if you're a Wall Streeter and you're chilling out on Sunday playing golf and you hear that there's a press conference tonight with Janet Yellen and Powell, you rush home. I mean, you get on the phone and you find out, holy crap, what broke? Right. So it's almost like, you know, the reassurances are the crack in the plane wing. So that's kind of where we are. And, you know, I had a couple articles this week that were talking about kind of the bigger picture here, which is hyperinflation, because fundamentally what's breaking both this, all these problems in our financial system and, you know, what's driving the inflation we're suffering under, but also inflation in countries like Argentina, what is driving all of this, the, you know, single force of nature is really government spending. We had a, you know, massive ramp up in federal spending during COVID. They had to buy the lockdowns. The way to do that was to pay a large proportion of Americans to essentially sit on the couch and continue getting paid. And that, it bought them the lockdowns. You know, a lot of us at the time, we were sitting around wondering, like, what happened to Americans? Like, how are Americans supporting these totalitarian restrictions? And, well, the answer is they were being paid. And who were they being paid by? Why? The federal government. With the Federal Reserve financing it. So that was sort of the original sin this time around. That put us up at inflation rates in double digits. And, you know, when we ask what's kind of the end game on this, you know, I've got another recent article talking about my base case, which is that we're essentially reliving the 1970s, where you had this double hump of inflation. So first it got real high, it got around double digits. That lasted for, I think, about 2 years. The Fed reacted the exact same way that it is now, which is that they hiked up rates to choke off the private economy. They did not have a tough conversation with government about spending. They did exactly what they did now, which is pretend they don't see it and strangle the private sector instead. What happened in the 1970s is that led to a tremendous crash in the real economy. So there was one point where the statistics at the time said that they had a 10% decline in economic output at an annualized rate in a single quarter. And that absolutely panicked the Fed. They said, holy crap. They fear inflation because they know the voters will blame them for it, but they also fear a severe crash because they know that voters will blame them for that too. So the Fed panicked, they reversed course, they slashed rates. And what happened at that point, of course, is that inflation came roaring right back, because what was driving it was not Mr. Putin's war, or it actually wasn't even the oil embargo, which was the scapegoat in the 70s, along with overpopulation, by the way. Literally blame the 1970s inflation on overpopulation. The chairman of the Fed had a number of speeches doing that. At any rate, it turned out it wasn't these scapegoats. Instead, it was government spending. The government spending kept going. They were doing the guns and the butter. So the Vietnam War, the military-industrial complex two-faced the Soviets, and then they paired that with this massive ramp-up of welfare and a bureaucratic oversight, under Nixon and under LBJ. So they had their guns and butters. Spending was soaring. So once the Fed pulled rates back down and made money cheap again, it was off to the races. And at that point, it was about 3 years that we had a inflation that was even worse than the first. Okay, so, you had a little bit at first, chilled out for a couple of years, and it just came roaring back. At that point, there were a lot of people who felt like inflation was going to be permanent. And what happened is, basically, we as a country got lucky. The very inflationist Jimmy Carter happened to appoint the guy, Paul Volcker, who turned out to be really the hardest money Fed president that we've had since the beginning of the Fed, 110 years ago. And Volcker ramped up rates. He put rates at 17 or 18%. It costs you like 18% to get a mortgage. I mean, it was absolutely devastating for the economy. They had a pair of recessions. Those recessions cost Jimmy Carter the election, but they brought in Ronald Reagan. But what they did do was ended inflation finally. And my concern there is that, from Washington's perspective, Paul Volcker ending inflation was a catastrophic mistake, right? Because Jimmy Carter lost his job. He got blamed for the recessions. The Democrats had almost a 50-year strangle, like monopoly on the Senate that they had first gotten under FDR. And they lost that during that pair of recessions, right? So from Washington's perspective, they are never going to do that again, not in living memory. They've, lesson learned, do not take one for the team. Do not fix a out of control inflation at the expense of the economy. And so if we get to that 1970s replay where inflation comes roaring back even worse than the first time, I don't think Washington's going to pull a Volcker. It's not in their interest to pull a Volcker. They're going to keep scapegoating. They're going to keep hoping that the media can, explain it away, that Paul Krugman can declare more victory.
Yeah, which begs the question, how quickly could this escalate? Because, I'm sure you've seen it. I think I've seen you retweet it, but all the anecdotal data out there of people complaining. That's the weird thing about 2023 is that people can get on their phones and take a selfie video of all the trouble they're experiencing in their everyday lives. And it's this bad now. It's hard to imagine what it's going to be like if that inflation comes roaring back. Did it even go away in the first place is another question.
Yeah, we've got a whole bunch of indicators that are basically saying that the economic growth that we have, GDP growth and the job situation, in the case of consumer spending, economic growth, those things, a lot of that is just being funded by credit cards. So you've got, it was just out recently, Fidelity did a study of 401k hardship withdrawals, and those are soaring, right? So people are cashing out their retirement accounts to keep the spending up. You've got record credit card debt. you know, essentially people ran out of cash and now they're running it on plastic. But the thing is, most Americans, this point, almost 60% of Americans, they cannot cover a $1,000 unexpected cost. Okay. And so now you've got millions more who are draining their retirement accounts, who are loading up on credit card debt, which, by the way, pays 21% at the moment. I mean, it's, and this is before the recession hits, right? Before it hits in full, right? This is, you know, when allegedly we have this amazing growth. We probably talked about jobs as well last time, that a lot of that is smoke and mirrors, where, you know, you've got about 5 million Americans who dropped out of the labor force during COVID. A lot of them retired early. Some of them went on to government benefits. For a while there, government was essentially no questions asked on benefits because of COVID. And so you've, you know, once people go on to benefits, it kind of becomes a poverty trap. If you earn money, then they're going to take it away, right? So once you go into that, you might earn something black market on the side, but people, a lot of people, once they go on welfare, they're never, ever coming back. So we've got about 5 million missing Americans. And if you added those back on, then we'd be looking at an unemployment rate of 6.5% to 7.5% right now, right? The only reason why we're not seeing the misery is because all of those government benefits are covering a lot of those people. Or if it's the older ones who are early retired, they're draining out their retirement accounts. So, you know, this sort of sets the stage for where we are here before the recession hits in full. If we look back historically, right, recessions, typically they lag the Fed. So when the Fed hikes rates, it usually takes something like 18 months for the recession to hit. So on that schedule, we're still a good year away from the full brunt of the recession. And, you know, taking it back to government spending, again, historically, if you look back at the couple of the last couple of recessions, every single time government just cranks up the money printers, and especially the deficits, because when a recession hits, a lot of people lose their jobs or they have lower income if they have a business or investments. So they're not paying as much tax. And then meanwhile, you got millions of people who newly lose their jobs, right? They're laid off. Or they're going through financial distress, they lose their homes. So they go on government welfare now. So if we extrapolate from the past couple of recessions, then, you know, my guess is that next time around, we're going to be looking at not a $2 trillion deficit, which is what we're running now. We could be looking at a $4 trillion deficit. So at that point, the amount that the government's financing, it's not $10 trillion, now it's $12 trillion. You know, now it's 60% of the entire banking, all of the money in all of the deposits in the United States. It starts to get to a goofy amount of money. And, you know, taking it back to Argentina, for example, the kind of deficits that we're running in the US right now, as a percent of the economy, we're actually almost twice what they're running in Argentina. That's before Milei comes on. So basket case Argentina running 143% inflation is apparently far more fiscally prudent than the US government at this stage. So I think, you know, when we sort of go through the usual suspects for what's going to break this time around, I think there's a very good chance that it could be sovereign debt. Sovereign debt is too big to bail out. Okay, there is not enough money in the world. The sums involved are absolutely astronomical.
Yeah, and when you consider the fact that we need to roll over, what, one third of the 33.7 trillion that we have in the next 2 years. Yep. And then that's essentially a race between, does a recession come soon enough to force the Fed to lower rates, so that you refinance that at lower levels, or if that doesn't materialize, what's that look like when you have to refinance all that debt at these interest rates?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the problem was, it kind of came from 2008. I think 2008 gave them a false sense of confidence. And the lesson that the Fed took away from that is that if anything breaks, if anything goes wrong, just shoot it with $1 trillion. It'll go away. And, you know, but you want to zoom out for a sec. So the amounts involved in 2008, you know, the main bailout mechanism back then, that was TARP, that was about $800 billion. $800 billion is nothing now. You couldn't make a dent with that, right? When we had the bank crisis earlier this year, we don't know how many fictitious assets they basically allowed banks to pretend that their assets were worth what they bought them for and not what they are today, which would be trillions involved. Even beyond that, you know, their first reaction was to say essentially that every FDIC or actually every uninsured bank deposit in America was going to be guaranteed, all right, which is about $20 trillion. Now, they can't actually fulfill that promise. The FDIC itself has about 1% of that. I think it's, let's see, $100 billion on $20 trillion. Yeah, so I mean, they're essentially promising things that they can't possibly do. But the point is that, you know, we've gone from $800 billion. And I mean, that was a big deal back then. A lot of people were upset. They were like, you know, you're going to hand Wall Street $800 billion. And now, I mean, it sounds naive. You know, it's like charming little numbers. It sounds like we're talking about the 16th century, about $3 million national debt or something. It's just a silly number. So I think at this point, they really are going for broke. That, you know, it's the loot the treasury stage of the decline of empire. And, you know, the question is whether there's some, like, is there some break on it, right? Is there some guardrail that's going to head this thing off? And for a long time in American politics, the Republicans were the suckers. You know, they would be the ones who, there would be an election, the Democrats would say, we're going to have this, you know, the party is just going to be outrageous. You guys, you never seen how much we're going to spend on this party. And then these idiot Republicans would be there like, yeah, what I'm going to do is clean up for her. I'm going to charge everybody, you know, $100 to clean up after the party. So they always lost. And, you know, you had first Reagan and then Trump who discovered that that's a chump game. You know, you're not going to win an election promising to close down the party and clean up what's been done. Okay, in other words, to cut spending and to start paying down debt. You are not going to win that way. And so at this point, both major parties in the United States are essentially on the same page. The only thing they disagree on is what they're going to spend the trillions on. Is it going to be on war? Is it going to be on, you know, equity or climate? But either way, like it's hard to see what could actually stop the runaway federal spending beyond just, you know, literally going off the cliff and having some kind of sovereign debt crisis, at which point it fixes itself because you can't borrow money anymore. So, you know, it's kind of the quickest way to get a balanced budget is to go bust, default, and then nobody will lend you money anymore.
Yeah. I mean, and that's just the problems here at home. I mean, yeah, rumors right. started spreading last week. Who knows how much validity there are to them? I wrote about it on Friday, but then I saw some stuff over the weekend that said it may have been fake news, but there was two headlines out of UBS. First, their CEO at some risk management association event for some reason or another saying that if UBS was going to be bought, he'd prefer to be a private entity buying the bank, which is something you wouldn't expect the CEO of one of the largest banks in the world to say. And then there was that screenshot yeah. of somebody saying that they couldn't withdraw money because some of the UBS branches were having liquidity issues. And so that, I mean, that's why I had you on earlier this year was in the wake of the banking crisis that popped off here in the U.S., but it seems like, speaking of gremlins, those gremlins within the banking sector specifically are still there, popping up, yeah. obviously, with treasuries being the liquid reserves on a lot of these balance sheets and the treasury markets moving in the way they have throughout this year. It seems like that problem's only getting worse, and people are just trying to keep it out of mind, out of sight, but it seems like anything could happen at any moment where a liquidity crisis could pop up.
Yeah, well, Switzerland, just a couple of weeks ago, they news leaked out that they had floated the idea of capital controls. They call it friction tech, quote unquote. And the idea is to make it difficult for people to withdraw their money from banks. And, you know, of course, once it got out there, they immediately said, no, that's crazy talk. Yes, we were talking about it, but we're not really considering, you know, so they went into damage control mode, which, I mean, of course they have to because, you know, Switzerland at this point. So traditionally they had two giant banks, Credit Suisse and UBS, and Credit Suisse went down earlier this year. So there was kind of a shotgun marriage brokered by the Swiss government. They had a huge sweetener. I think they gave them like $55 billion or something. To take on Credit Suisse. But at this point now, UBS is like a third of bank deposits in Switzerland. In U.S. terms, that would be like an $8 trillion bank, I mean, that is too big to bail out. Like the amount that the Fed pumped out for COVID, right? That was about $6 trillion in the first couple of years. So, I mean, you would literally have to, what, put that down on a bank. Something like 90% of the publicly traded companies in Switzerland do business with UBS. I mean, it is absolutely too big to fail. And this is happening in a lot of countries now. We're seeing in the U.S. where the smaller banks are failing. They're being gobbled up by the too big to fail gang. And it's understandable why that happened. I mean, partly, you know, the regional banks have been particularly reckless. But fundamentally, ever since 2008, the message that's gone out to the banking sector is that you've got to get too big to fail as soon as possible so that you can hold taxpayers hostage, right? You want to get to a situation where the government is compelled to bail you out, because 2008 worked like a charm for the American banking system, right? They got to run for 10 years making money hand over fist by taking on risk and by lying about the assets. And so, you know, every year they banked that. They got to go with the, you know, with the yachts and the hookers, the blow, and gave, you know, fantastic dividends back to their shareholders. And then when it came time to pay the piper, the taxpayer covered it. I mean, just what a racket that was. So, you know, banks all over the world are in the same situation where if they can just get big enough, they can get over that line to the point that they're too big to fail, then the taxpayer will give them anything they need to avoid that. So that's really where Switzerland is at this point. And it's shocking, you know, for those of us who remember Switzerland as a paragon of stability and prudence. I mean, it's shocking for the Swiss government to be sitting there carrying water, talking about restricting depositors, locking them into failing banks with this so-called friction tech. It's astounding. And it's also something the Fed has been putting out a lot of papers about friction tech. You know, they were caught blind on the Silicon Valley bank run. You know, traditionally meaning the past 20, 30 years, bank runs would occur over a course of weeks, okay? And in the case of Silicon Valley Bank, it was like hours. I mean, it was lightning fast. And that freaked out the Federal Reserve. And so now the Federal Reserve is also floating friction tech. And, you know, they're kind of playing the Washington game, which is that first you put out a bunch of academic papers talking about this very clever idea. You decorate it with jargon. You try to make it look sciencey. And then you get, you know, your cronies in Congress to carry this stuff through and say, well, you know, experts say that we're going to have to lock people into failing banks. No doubt they'll come up with some cute words to describe it. Friction tech is already pretty cute. But, you know, that is, I think, where we're headed. And you have to go that route. If your banks are too big to bail out, then, you know, you've got to make the depositors bail them out instead, right? You got to lock everybody in there to the crashing banks.
Yeah, that may be the biggest difference when comparing hyperinflationary events of the last century to the potential hyperinflationary event that could happen in the U.S. and just in the West more broadly, because it seems like the global economy is so interconnected that if it happens here, it's going to happen pretty much everywhere. And like social media, particularly this digital age, just throws jet fuel and accelerant on all of this.
Exactly. Yeah, the level of connection between countries is probably comparable or maybe even a little bit less than it was going into, certainly in the 1910s, that was kind of the golden age of globalization. But, you know, if you go into 1929, that's probably comparable to what we're looking at today. But you're right, the huge difference between now and then is that news travels very fast. A lot of banks offer, you know, 24/7 service. You can take your money out at 3 a.m. And, you know, that is going to accelerate these bank runs. And, you know, it sort of puts back into focus the fundamental flaw of our system, which is that the global banking system everywhere in the world is it is permanently insolvent because of fractional reserve banking. So it permanently owes more than it has on hand. And, you know, this is very common in businesses. It's very common for a business to owe more money than it actually has. And that's called insolvency. That is bankruptcy. And, you know, if you actually go through all of the banks in every single country in the world, they are all always insolvent. So why aren't they wound up? You know, why aren't they bankrupt? Because central banks stand ready to bail them out. That's been the deal ever since the beginning. of central banking. That's Walter Badgett. Lender of last resort is the term, and Badgett is like, he's the the Jesus Christ for bankers. Okay, like whatever he said is law. He was writing in 1870 or something. That is how the system is built. It is built to be bailed out. And, you know, but again, that was designed in an age where bank runs didn't run to the size that they can today, or at the speed. It's also built for an era where banks were not as concentrated as they are today. So, you know, if you're looking at, you know, what I think JP Morgan is past $2 trillion at this point, and you combine that with, you know, 24/7 bank withdrawals, then you have to massively ramp up the bailout mechanism. And if you do that, then you are doubling down on that moral hazard from 2008, right? You're doubling down on that lesson that banks get, that you should be as risky as possible, right? Because you'll always get bailed out. Because remember, in it, like one of the iron laws in finance is that more risk equals more return. Okay. And across a large number of asset classes, this is essentially always going to be the case. If you take bigger risks, you're going to make more profit for it. So if you are building this massive, like, it's not a safety net anymore. It's more like, you know, you're like enveloping them with taxpayer billions so that nothing bad can ever happen. If you're doing that, then your entire banking system is going to go for broke on the risk. And, you know, in the context of how big it's become, very quickly, it outgrows the ability to bail it out by governments. And at that point, the only way to bail the thing out is to siphon it from everybody, right? Take people's life savings and give it to bankers.
Yeah. Are you optimistic that Millay will be able to create a blueprint for beginning to get away from this with his staunch stance over the weekend that abolishing the Argentine central bank is non-negotiable? It's got to happen.
Yeah. I believe in Millay. I think he's the real deal. The concern is that he does not have a majority in Congress. And so at that point, the question is, you know, can he keep the Argentinian people focused and passionate about reform? Dollarization. So the idea is that the country would throw away its current currency. It would get rid of a central bank, but, like, you know, it wouldn't go into like the libertarian paradise of, you know, of like free banking or anything. It would essentially just trade. It would give like the bank supervisory functions, presumably to Treasury. We know this because there have been other countries that have dollarized, like El Salvador and Ecuador. And then the Argentinian peso would either be discarded or it would become moribund. Like, El Salvador still has a currency, but it's not used. Everybody in El Salvador uses the dollar. So that's the idea, essentially, of what he's pushing, is that the Argentinian economy would shift from the crappy peso that it's been suffering to the U.S. dollar. The results on that are really strong, right? So countries that have done that, such as Ecuador and El Salvador, inflation, of course, you know, collapses. It goes down to the U.S. level, which until very recently was quite good. But, you know, even the inflation of the past couple of years is a heck of a lot better than what, like, Ecuador used to suffer and what El Salvador is getting today. So, you know, you get good results out of it. In Ecuador and El Salvador, these passed under, like, regular governments. Okay, it did not take the libertarian dream team to get these reforms. So I think that there are people in some of these countries, like there are bankers even, who would like their country to be more stable, be a better environment for them to make money. So I think that even without having a majority in Congress, he may be able to get through dollarization, just because it's not that controversial, right? When we look at other countries that did it. In terms of, you know, slashing government by 60%, now that's going to be controversial, right? So something like one out of three Argentinians work for the government. It's going to be hard to keep them on side. You know, doubtless they're going to play the same game they do here. So, like, you know, anytime you propose to cut spending in Washington, they'll be like, well, we can cut spending, but we'll really have to start with Social Security. You know, you're like, yes, but do we have to do that? Is there nothing else we can cut? So, you know, they will play the game. They'll, you know, he was talking about what, getting rid of the, it's like the Ministry of Equity or something. And, you know, for sure, they're going to trot out, they're going to find some beneficiary who's super sympathetic. hold her up in the newspapers. The left wing or the media down there is relatively left wing like ours. So that I think they're going to fight tooth and nail. But, you know, dollarization itself, I think, does stand a good chance just because the record is so good and it's happened in relatively normal countries.
It would be a great shame, though, if they dollarized and then we just completely mess it up for them here.
Right. It's like great timing, guys. Like, you're going to jump on the dollar as soon as we break it. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I think that the trick with the US dollar, all fiat is doomed. I mean, this we know because fiat has been tried many, many times in history. Every single time is the same story, which is that fiat subsidized government spending that then leads to inflation and eventually gets out of hand. They can't pay the soldiers and then, you know, something changes. So we know that fiat is doomed. But I think what's interesting about the US dollar is that on the way to fiat death, I think the most likely scenario is that the dollar may actually get stronger along the way, because what happens is even weaker currencies, they go first. Okay. And either they, you know, are abandoned like Ecuador did, and they just swap over the dollar, or, you know, they die on their own like Venezuela. And in Venezuela, people are shifting over. A lot of them are shifting to the dollars. Many are also shifting to stable coins. Many are shifting to Bitcoin. Right. So, but either way, each currency that dies, it's like the US dollar absorbs the corpses of all the other currencies on the way to Ragnarok. So it would be nice if they could just like make a jump to either a gold-backed currency or to actually, you know, having the first Bitcoin backed currency. That's probably outside the Overton yet. I think we're going to have to get a lot more failed currencies before, you know, any country is going to be willing to consider that.
Yeah. The milkshake theory. Every weak currency fails into the dollar.
Exactly.
It'd be interesting, though. It seems like markets are beginning to price this in. Obviously, Bitcoin's up well over 100% this year. Gold is up at, like, I think, $2,012 today. So there is at least a hedge being put on of people looking at the sovereign debt crisis and all the chaos in the world right now and putting their dollars in the hard money.
For sure. It's I don't know whether it's good or bad, but since Bitcoin was invented, the world has stumbled into like every argument for Bitcoin, right? Like, you know, first it was a banking crisis and then it was widespread censorship. You remember under Trudeau and, you know, you had Bitcoiners going over there and, you know, trying to get the truckers funding in the face of a totalitarian government. Then you had the inflation. Now you got bank crashes. It's like every argument for Bitcoin is just playing out in real time one by one. And it's funny, you know, because like if you were there at the very beginning of Bitcoin, you said, you know, okay, so Bitcoin fixes this, that, and the other. That's like a running joke in the Bitcoin community, right? How, you know, we always say Bitcoin fixes this and, you know, they're like, yeah, yeah. And, you know, so all of the yeah, yeahs are actually happening now, right? Like, you know, you've got double digit inflation, even in the US, which that was certainly not on anybody's bingo card. And you know, you've got what, 143% Argentina. You got something like 10 countries now that have 40-50% inflation or higher. And that number is spreading. The IMF thinks that, you know, the next 2 years are going to be at least as bad as we've been going through, with high inflation, slow growth. The slow growth then feeds into even higher inflation because you don't have enough stuff, right? So if the government's still printing money and you're not making more stuff, then the inflation accelerates again. So yeah, it's almost like the world is like a running commercial for Bitcoin at this point.
Yeah. And on top of that, I mean, we talked about Malay, but you also mentioned the populist win in the Netherlands over the weekend as well. It seems like the economic pressure is becoming so immense that people are throwing their hands up and saying, hey, we need to figure something out. Let's go with these populist candidates that are promising to clean things up.
Yeah. And that kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the top where, you know, this sort of ruling left-wing elite, almost on a global basis, they have become so divorced from voters that they're opening this massive gap now. And, you know, I think so far they've been counting on a pliant media. They've been also counting on captured institutions to, you know, sort of put out propaganda for them, to cover it up, particularly to try and taint any opposition. I mean, they just reached for the F word like immediately. You know, they call them far right. And I mean, they were calling Javier Milei far right. Okay, so when they say far right, they're referring to like German corporals in the 1930s. A radical libertarian is the precise opposite. You know, like Ron Paul and Austrian corporals are the exact opposite. But they're, you know, shameless. And anybody who is promising something that voters actually want, they go after the messenger, right? They try to tar them. And I mean, again, if I were rooting for them, if I were on their side, I'd be like, what the heck are you doing? Like, why don't you just adopt the policy? Like, you know, if you're afraid of these policies because the voters like them too much, what am I missing, guys? Like, just adopt this stupid policy. But they're not. And, you know, I suspect that's because they believe that media and these captured institutions give them enough insurance, give them enough protection that they can just cater to the special interests, the cronies, military industrial complex, the financial industrial complex, the censorship industrial complex. You know, they're just multiplying.
Yeah. Yeah. The marginal return on throwing the far right label on people is diminishing rapidly. People are like, all right, you're.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got people ironically embracing it just because they're sick of the slander. And I mean, the irony is that if they actually hated the genuine far right, then they would not try to conflate normal things with them, right? Rather, they would, you know, they would keep the actual bad guys isolated. So, you know, I think this is just coming from fundamentally an evil place. In other words, they are actually promoting the genuine evil far right because they're trying to look for an electoral strategy where they can shut out a bunch of guys who are, you know, trying to do pretty common sense policies for people, bring prices down, get job growth up, not let, you know, every single undocumented human in the world waltz into your country and go on welfare. I mean, these are fairly common sense for a lot of voters, really, every single place in the world. For the record, if an undocumented Guatemalan sneaks into Mexico, they have camps with razor wire that they put them into. The only reason they're letting them slide now is because they're moving on, right? But historically, Mexico has been absolutely brutal to illegal immigrants. Every country on earth has always been. People don't want that. If you're invited in, that's one thing. You know, if somebody visits your house, you invite them in, that's one thing. If somebody just, it's very, very different if people just show up uninvited. But yeah, you know, if you look at the dynamics and you kind of look at the trends on it, I don't think it's changing. You do see a lot of media hand-wringing about how Biden is unpopular, but a lot of that, you know, is sort of still on the tactical level where, you know, he needs better messaging. And like, I think if you're a New York Times reporter or a Bloomberg reporter and you come out and say, you know what, maybe we do need a wall on the board. I mean, you are, you're out of a job. Like, you know, you better line up your interview with Daily Caller before you put out that article.
Yeah. And I mean, we saw it pop off in Ireland.
Yeah.
Over the Thanksgiving holiday as well. It seemed, yeah, people are just being pushed to the edge. And there's too many of these instances back to back to back where it's like, all right, what is going on here? I'm waking up in a country I do not recognize anymore. It's completely run incompetently by these governments or pushing us into debt. Right. Inflation's high. I can't get a good job. And you're telling me I'm a racist.
Yeah. And I mean, that's why they're so obsessed with censorship. You know, like if you believe that the voters want your product, then, you know, just show them the product. you know, this emphasis on shutting down the other side and shutting them up, whether it's by, you know, calling them far right or whether it's by literally taking away their voice, that is not a show of confidence, right? That's what you do when you're convinced that you've got a losing message. And, you know, again, I'm just mystified. Like, if they know they have a losing message, why don't they change the message? But they don't.
No, I mean, here in the U.S., it's actually pretty frightening. They're locking people up. Mm-hmm. I mean, the one guy is in jail for 18 months for a Hillary Clinton meme.
It's astounding.
The January 6th political prisoners. And then that video, that all that footage came out last week. It's like, are these people really that bad? Or are they really trying to overthrow the government? I don't think so.
Yeah, people still talk about the jailing of socialists. Eugene Debs, I think I think that was Wilson. It might have been FDR. But, you know, that was he was a socialist. He was popular back then. He was arguing against the war. And so they put him in jail. And 100 years later, we still talk about him. Apparently, not all of us remember which war he was. But we still talk about it as a dark stain on American history that we actually jailed political opposition. And where we are today, from the Hillary meme to the J6ers, to, you know, the prosecutions of Donald Trump. I mean, it's just absolutely shocking. This is the kind of thing, this will be discussed for centuries. This is not a, you know, 1 week news story here. This will absolutely be discussed. This is a concerning, you know, step on the path towards banana republic.
Yeah. Which brings us to the 2024 election. What are you expecting or looking for?
My best guess, I've had people tell me I'm an idiot, so that is always a possibility. Okay, my best guess is that they're going to run the primaries partway, like through March, so that Joe Biden wins a bunch, and they're going to get him to win a bunch. And then at that point, he's going to retire for health reasons, and I think it's going to go to a convention. So this is what happened in 1968. Essentially, if the candidate drops out partway through the primaries, then how do you decide who you're candidate is? Well, you know, you fast forward to the convention in like July or August or something, and all of the delegates, all of the, you know, party officials, they vote on who they want the president or who they want their party's candidate to be. So that's my guess, just because everybody in the Democratic Party knows that Biden can't do it. But on the other hand, I think they also believe that nobody else is actually popular among Democrat voters. And so, you know, if they do that, then come, let's say, August at the convention, I guess they'll vote for somebody like Gavin Newsom, and then he'll be candidate. If I had to bet, they're going to cheat a whole bunch again, probably more than last time, because the stakes are higher after what they've done to Mr. Trump. So I would guess that they cheat. And that's really, I think, where the battlefield is going to be fought, is can we pass laws in purple states to prevent election fraud to the point that, you know, is actually a competitive election.
Yeah, I think they're going to trot out Michelle Obama. I think
they might. That's what my wife thinks as well. It strikes me as goofy, but like a lot goofier stuff has happened over the past couple of years. So yes, distinct possibility.
I mean, we were talking about it earlier. Maybe that's part of their strategy, like just letting Joe Biden speak in public multiple times a week. It's becoming glaringly obvious. It's like, this dude is not fit for the job. You're going to have to replace him with somebody. Obviously, they forced RFK to run as an independent. Gavin Newsom, I think it would be very easy to attack him. Just point at California. Like,
you
want this for the country. Sure. Then,
yeah, exactly.
Napoleon Michelle Obama, be like, first woman president.
First woman president, she's untainted by failure because she's never actually been in office. So, you know, the easiest way to never fail is to never do anything. She's been excellent at that. So, yeah, no, it is entirely possible.
Yeah. It's also tiresome, though. I get extremely exhausted from the election cycles. It's like we do this. Yes. Nothing ever changes.
Right.
And yet a bunch of the country's intellectual capital is sucked. And their attention is sucked into this election process. And it's not even a 4-year cycle. The election starts, 18 months before each election.
Yeah.
Then you have midterms. So it's maybe get a 12-month break between the bickering and the attention suck.
No, it is. And, you know, Gallo's humor is pretty much all we have left. So, you know, we do laugh about it, the clown show in Washington. But, you know, I mean, the issues are serious, right? I mean, you've got, you know, millions of Americans who are on the edge. You were talking earlier about the videos, right? You've got all these millennials and they're talking like, you know, the lifestyle that they grew up in, right? Where, you know, they had like, you know, a two-family, what is it? A two-person income. They lived in a house that like their parents actually owned. And, you know, they can't imagine that lifestyle now, right? Like for them, what they have to look forward to is maybe living with roommates, right? Eating ramen at 40, You know, I mean, like they're not going to be able to get married. They're not going to be able to have a family. They're certainly not going to own a house. So these people are in distress. And then meanwhile, right, you know, Washington is just playing games. At least the Democrat Party is playing games, which I think is still the odds-on favorite to win, unfortunately, in 2024. So, you know, and you do hear this from a lot of these videos where there are people who they would consider themselves old Democrats. Okay, so they had joined the party. They had grown up in the party when it was like genuinely fighting for the little guy. You know, was interested in like workers and, you know, working class families and things like that. And, you know, now, of course, I mean, the party has all but declared war on the working class because it associates the working class with Trump. You know, so anything that the working class does, like if they go to McDonald's, if they watch football, you know, if they like fireworks, if they buy pickup trucks, like anything that the working class does is just automatically tainted as, you know, ideally they call it far right, of course, or privileged or, you know, whatever combination of terms they're using. But it's such a betrayal, really, like, you know, if you were that sort of old Democrat, you know, if you believed in that original message of sort of fighting for the little guy, it really is a betrayal to just completely turn on the base. And for what? For, you know, a bunch of crony billionaire green, you know, companies, or what? For like, you know, the university eggheads sitting around feeling superior. I mean, it's just, to me, it's just like the unforced error of the century. Because, you know, if most of my life, like Republicans have been the party of those jokers, right? Of either big business or of, you know, people who feel like they're superior to the rest of the country. And like, why would the and that always hurt the Republicans, right? Like I grew up in Philadelphia and, you know, normal people who are Democrats and, you know, plutocrats and, you know, corrupt millionaires out of the country club, they were Republicans. Okay, so that was like not a good spot to occupy in a democracy. Okay, you want to be for the common man. And so why the heck they threw that away? I mean, just what an unforced error. I think they just got bought. They got bribed out of, you know, really a commanding position in U.S. politics.
Yeah, and that's the real scary part, too. And something I've been trying to get at is like, how is this situation, the setup, different than these historical examples of hyperinflation or just the empire dissolving? When you watch those videos, and I'm a millennial, talk to right. your friend group, and then you look at Gen Z as well. Like there's a psychological aspect where a lot of these videos that we're talking about, it's essentially by the end, they tap out and say, why am I even doing this? And you can have that
right.
psychological breakdown where people are going to jobs to be Excel monkeys that do things that they really don't think are adding value to the world. And is there a point where they tap out, zone out, just go on the teat? I don't think that's being factored in at all. Is this generational tap out?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's kind of one of the, you know, challenges in economics is that we're often talking about like GDP and inflation and job growth and productivity and things like that. And the thing is, when you translate those into the real world, that's exactly what it looks like, right? It's people who, you know, they can't do what they always dreamed of doing. They've got to do some BS job that, you know, they're going to be doing that until they're 70. They're depressed. They don't see any purpose to life. They often vote that depression. You know, they end up feeling like nothing is really particularly worth preserving. You may as well watch it all burn because it sucks right now. So, you know, it's like if you're playing billiards, you know, and you don't have a good shot. And so you just kind of hit all the balls in the center and screw it. Let's just see what happens. And, you know, I think for a lot of millennials, that's almost the approach that they're now seeing in the world is it sucks. So what the hell? We may as well change it. You know, whether it's communism or, you know, whatever, it can't be any worse than this. And I mean, A, that's never the case. It can always be a heck of a lot worse. But, you know, that's really when you sum up, you know, the slow growth, the high inflation, the tapping out retirement savings, the not being able to accumulate any kind of savings, not being able to build up a down payment for the house. When you sort of translate those into the real world, that's exactly what it looks like. It looks like people who just don't see any reason to get up in the morning.
Yeah. Black pill. Let's end it on a white pill, though. I know you got to go here in 5 minutes. I mean, I think there are a lot of things to be optimistic about. People are waking up to this.
Yes.
You know, a lot of talk about the strafe. Yep. First part of solving a problem is identifying it exists in the first place. People are beginning to identify the problems. They're seeing it in their everyday lives. Obviously, we have Bitcoin. Those are the only things to be positive about. How do we... That's the other thing. And they're noticing the tax problem as well. Like, I'm working this hard. Yeah. The income tax is very high. I'm paying state's tax. I'm taxed at the grocery store. I'm taxed everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, what is the things that people can be doing external to government influence that begin to claw back to some sense of sanity?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm extremely optimistic. I know it sounds goofy because, like, you know, most of what I talk about, you know, what I try to talk about in the videos is I want people to wake up. Okay, like, a lot of us understand what's happening, but a lot of people still don't. Okay, and like, I want the frog to wake up before the water is actually boiling. All right, so I do accentuate the bad things that are happening. There's tons of good things that are happening. You know, if you look at school choice or Second Amendment rights, I mean, they've just been on an absolute tear. Like, as catastrophic as the economy's been for the past 10 years, when you talk about things like that, which, I mean, you could argue those are just as important, right? The ability to save your children from the propaganda machine, your ability to defend your family, those are, you know, those are similarly important things. We've been absolutely on a tear. There are a lot of ways where we're making ground, but really when I zoom out, like, the reason I'm optimistic is because if you compare similar situations in history, okay, so even just in the US, there have been many times when things have been as bad or worse than they are today. You know, if you take FDR, heck, you can take the post-World War II censorship era where we had, you know, we had essentially socialists in charge of the entire U.S. government. You had zero way to get your message out. Murray Rothbard, the economist, he talked about in the 1970s, you get the entire liberty movement in America into a single living room in New York. All right, the liberty movement in America in the 70s was by far the most developed on earth of any country. I mean, you're talking 2-3 people in like New Zealand or something. I mean, it was just absurd, right? You compare that to today, right, where yes, we're censored on the internet, but compared to a living room in the 1970s, my God, we can get our message out. So if we survived those times, then, I mean, I am extremely optimistic for what's going to come next. Democracy is also, of course, you know, we were just talking about the censorship and the cheating. But again, compared to most of human history, and particularly compared to the eras when liberty won, okay, governments are always trying to crush liberty. It is like a historical constant. There is no moment in history when governments were not trying everything they could to crush liberty. And yet it won over and over. And, you know, now we have, not only do we have certainly a formal democracy that it still has a lot of elements, right? We're still at a point where if like 80% of Americans reject the candidate, they're not going to cheat past that because they don't have confidence that they're going to be able to get away with it. If they can't get away with it, then the other side is going to punish them afterwards. Okay, so between the quasi-fair elections that we have, certainly in a historical context, and the ability that we have to communicate over the internet, I am extremely optimistic. In a sense, I think that the next couple of years is going to be a pretty tough storm. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of misery. But I think on the other side of that, that the severity of the storm is going to bring enough people on side that I think that we're going to have a renaissance. I think where the water is going to start boiling, but I'm confident that because of the size of our movement, not least the Bitcoin community, which is extraordinarily passionate and, you know, spreading like wildfire now. I think that, you know, you put those together and we are going to get to a Javier Milei style, you know, frog jumping moment a heck of a lot faster than we would have, you know, in the 70s or than it took Argentina to get to.
Yeah. It's all right in front of us. We have the tools, the communication tools, the monetary tools, the software tools to build our way out of this. It's just like you said, waking enough people up to be like, all right, there's a problem. Let me go focus on the solution by leveraging these tools.
Right. And in that context, if you've got a ruling elite that is like willfully, you know, ignoring the people, I mean, you could not ask for a better setup. Holy cow. Thanks, guys. I mean, they're literally like, you know, you don't have to fight them. You just have to wait until they screw it up bad enough. The key is that you have to connect the dots for people, right? You have to make people understand, no, this isn't people buying too many Pelotons. You know, this is actually government spending, or, you know, they're going to throw up excuses. But I mean, the excuses are flimsy. And as long as you're able to talk to people, I think you stand a very good chance that, you know, the more they screw it up, the more people come over to your side. And at some point, quote unquote, everybody knows that change is needed. You know, like you take the Soviet Union, right? So Tuesday morning, everybody was a committed Marxist, believed in it very deeply. Wednesday morning, nobody had ever been a Marxist. Everybody knew that it was, you know, silly. So I think that we do get to that moment. And Victor Davis Hanson, he had an article just out, I think, yesterday. And he was talking about the fact that, you know, a lot of these people, like these you know, captured academics and, you know, all these institutions, even the journalists, even the politicians, all of these people who are having a hand in the evil, they don't actually believe in it. They don't believe in anything. They don't care about anything. They are spineless. They will go to whoever is the highest bidder. Okay, so academics are all communists at the moment because that's what pays best, right? That's how you're going to get promoted. It's how you're going to have a bright career in academia. You know, somebody like Nancy Pelosi or Chuck Schumer, they don't believe in anything. You know, if it's in their interest, okay, if donors plus voters sum up to position X, they will adopt it in a second. You know, so we forget, like we often complain about how spineless politicians are, but there's a very big silver lining to that, which is that you almost don't have to fight them. Okay. Once things are bad enough and that brings enough people over to your side, right? Once you've skillfully explained exactly how the bad thing is causing, you know, misery to them, there is some point where the numbers flip and the entire thing just folds. It folds like the Soviet Union, right? I mean, just, you know, all of those captured institutions, all those lifelong committed Marxists whose entire careers were tied up with the, you know, system, they just like poof, flipped, right? Like an Othello board, just put one stone down and bam, every single person, the entire society flips. So I'm actually excited about it. You know, when I look at the tools we do have, I'm looking forward to what comes next. It's going to be tough between here and there, but I am very optimistic.
I am as well. And hopefully this episode is just a snowflake on the snowball gaining momentum that forces people onto the side of sanity and
it
logical
is, without
thinking.
Without a doubt. People like you speaking, you know, reaching, convincing new people, but also giving them arguments that they can then take to, you know, everybody in their life has convincible friends and family and whatnot. And yeah, you're absolutely a huge part of it.
Well, you've quickly become the economics professor of the internet. So I think you're doing a hell of a job yourself, sir.
Thank you.
How's it feel? You're the official economics professor of Twitter now, I think.
You know, there's a lot of pressure, so I'm going to have to go out of my way to make a really, really stupid video at some point. I actually did that. Like the very first video we did, it kind of took off and I was shocked. I was like, why would you want to watch this? And so, but I got nervous, right? Cause like, you know, you go from like talking to 50 people to a lot. And so, the second day we did a video that was, it was so bad. It's still up. Cause you know, I figure it's a teaching moment or something. I don't know. Maybe it'll inspire the next producer to do the same thing. But I mean, it's just so awful. And I'm like staring down and like the camera's at the ceiling.
Well, the quality and the consistency is extremely impressive. So thank you for doing it. I watch every video.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, you've been in the game for years and years. So seriously, carrying the torch.
Well,
carrying the light to people. Yeah, seriously, appreciate it.
We're optimistic here. More people are going to see the light. It's just going to take time. We just got to keep showing up, being consistent.
That's what it is.
Giving our daily lessons. Professor St. Ange, it's been a pleasure as always.
As always, it's great seeing you, Marty. Yep.
We'll have to do this in the new year.
Yes, I'm looking forward. Yeah, it'll be exciting. Maybe we'll be closer on that. On the nomination there. We'll see how those played out, if it's going to be Michelle or Gavin Newsom.
I'm telling you, don't sleep on Michelle. She's going to come out of nowhere. I can feel it.
All right, we'll see.
All right, you enjoy your day.
Yes,
thank
sir.
Thank you again.
You too.
Keep crushing it.
Thank you.
Peace and love, freaks.